This is Pastor Patrick Hines, and today we are live here. And wow, there's two people here. That's cool. I think the camera here is okay. I really didn't have a whole lot I was going to talk about today. There were a couple of emails I got that had some good questions. One was a tough question about the Sabbath day. It's a question that I've had to address in my own life when I lived in Ohio, where our families live, about getting together with family, especially, you know, if they're family that don't, they're not churchgoers, or they don't profess to be Christians. But often it's the only time that people get together is on Sunday. You know, what about doing that? And certainly we want to have, we want to be committed first and foremost to following and obeying God and doing what we believe is right in the sight of God first. But I used to be a little bit more rigid in my application of the Sabbath commandment, but it's not that I think the commandment requires less of us, but when I first became Reformed and first was introduced to the Reformed confessions, you know, you're not allowed to do anything on the Sabbath day, your worldly employments and recreations, and only the public and private exercises of God's worship. And the thing is, it's important to remember that the commandment also requires a holy resting, a holy resting. You cease from your normal vocation. That's really what's at the heart of the commandment. When you actually look at the wording of it in Exodus chapter 20, in fact, I'm going to pull up here, Exodus 20. I still haven't figured out how to make, how to put the Bible thing up on my camera when I'm doing a live feed. I can do it. You've seen, if you are a subscriber, if you watch any of my other videos, I can pull up stuff that you can see on the screen. I can't do that when I'm live streaming for some reason. I know there's got to be some way of doing it. I just don't know how to do it. So anyway, okay, the commandment in Exodus chapter 20 says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That's a real important opening phrase there, that term kadosh, to keep something holy, to be set apart. So the Sabbath day is a day that's different from the other days, and here's how it's different. 6 days, you labor and do all your work. Okay, so your normal vocation, unless you have a job that's like, you know, you're a police person, or you work in an emergency room, or, you know, it's important to have certain things that are at least available, like here and there, for works of necessity and mercy. If someone is traveling because they have a sick family member or a sick child or something like that, they need to be able to, you know, get a meal, get gas for the car or something like that. But in general, everything needs to shut down for a day. Okay, so you want to have a job that will give you the Sabbath day off, unless it's the type of job that is a required sort of thing for necessity and mercy, okay, like doctors and things like that. The seventh day, six days you shall labor and do all your work. So the Sabbath day really is a ceasing of your normal vocation for that whole day. And one of the things that this did for the people of Israel is it gave them an opportunity, number one, to rest. It also gave their livestock a chance to rest, and it gave the land, they're actually Sabbaths for the land itself, where you would give it a year off of being having things planted in it. And so the seventh day, of course, it's shifted to the Lord's Day today, is the Lord's Day Sabbath for the Christian people after the resurrection of Christ. We don't need to get into that here. That's kind of a long, involved a discussion, but the purpose of the Sabbath day was to have a day that you are not working, to give your body a rest and your mind a rest, and also to give you an opportunity to spend that time in a holy resting all the day, which is the way our confession describes it. Now, when it says that you're not to engage in your normal work, worldly employments and recreation, worldly recreation and employments, is that the things that you would normally do on the other days, you don't want to do on this day. Okay, like for example, in our presbytery, the presbytery that I came out of, in Westminster Presbytery, we told people, look, you need to not be doing organized sports on Sunday. Okay, that's chewing up the better part of the day on something that is not about resting, and it's not about the worship of God. And it's not right to do that. Okay? And we also want to avoid unnecessarily making other people work for us on the Sabbath day. Okay, so that's really what's at the heart of this. Now, the question was asked of me, and I think I did find the email here, if I can find it, from a person who listens faithfully and asks really good questions. Yeah, what are your thoughts on spending an afternoon on the Sabbath with unbelieving family members? They celebrate birthdays, holidays, they do it on Sunday afternoon, eat together, watch football, maybe watch a movie. None of them are believers. The conversation is never about godly topics. So that's a tough question, and we dealt with that when I was in Ohio. And the way that we dealt with it was, you know, we just thinking about it, wanting to say, look, whatever the cost of being faithful to God, you want to pay that cost. And if that means your family, you know, thinks that you're stupid or you're a legalist or you're psychotic or something, then, you know, so be it. But I really looked at it as a work of mercy to spend a little time with family that we otherwise probably would very rarely or almost never see them. And I wanted to have that contact. We wanted to have that contact with them. And that's paid dividends. That's been a good thing. But not to spend the whole day. Maybe a short time and then, you know, the rest of the time. That's a work of mercy to them. But then, you know, you don't miss worship. You make sure that you go. If your church, you know, if your church has two services on Sunday, you should go to both of them. It's actually one of the reasons we do it. There's several reasons that we have an evening service. One is to bookend the Sabbath day with another worship service. And also to give a second opportunity to hear the preaching of the Word of God and so that you have more teaching from the Scripture going into your heart and soul and for your family to discuss. But also, it's to help keep the day focused. It's to help keep the day focused on the things that are the most important. Now, I don't have any problem with, like, taking a nap on the Sabbath day. That's something that's fairly rare. The last several Sundays, though, I don't know, like, in God's merciful providence, I've felt so exhausted. When I get done preaching on Sunday morning, I mean, it's kind of like, it just takes everything out of you. And by the time I get home, I just feel like I'm going to fall over. And normally, it's real hard to do that because I have a house filled with children. I have 10 kids, and 9 of them still live at home. And a lot of them are very small, very little. And so they want to, you know, they need constant attention. I have to watch them and take care of them. It's not like I'm going to have my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old and my 6-year-old sitting with their faces down in front of a Bible the whole day. It's not going to happen. We do extra devotions on the Sabbath day and talk about, you know, Dad's sermon or we read from other sections of the Bible. I've been reading them. A biography of B.B. Warfield. Man, Reformation Heritage just published a whole series of these short illustrated biographies about some of the greatest Christian theologians and people. I should put a link to that on here. Just wonderful stuff. And the one about Warfield is great. My kids have really been enjoying that. I've been reading that on the Sabbath day to them. But you don't want something to chew up the better part of the day, even if it's a work of mercy in that way. That you're going to spend some time with family that they don't get together any other day. I don't think it's necessary to completely cut that off. Just remember, the Sabbath day is a day that's to be set apart from the other days. It's not to be, it's a day for man. It's not to be a hindrance to living your Christian life. It's supposed to help it. Okay, and it's good. If you can take a nap, I've been able to get away a couple times and actually lay down and fall asleep. Usually someone ends up jumping on me on the couch or something or wakes me up, and it's pretty hard to actually take a nap. The last couple Sundays, you know, everyone's been pretty chill and mellow. The kids go to their rooms and just chill out, and it's amazing. That normally does not happen, so that's actually been a good thing to actually catch a 45-minute or an hour-long nap on a Sunday. So it's a day for a holy resting. It's a day for works of necessity and mercy. It is a good day to visit people that you normally wouldn't otherwise see, shut-ins from church or people that are sick, that kind of thing. And it's a great day to spend in discussion of biblical things. We always try to do that at home. We talk about we're reading through the book of 1 Kings as a family, at family devotions lately. Or once in a while, I'll pull another passage if I think that there's something somewhere else in Scripture that we should read through and discuss and talk about. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we do on Sunday. You know, sitting and watching a football game, that would trouble me a little bit. I would feel like, you know, that's just not something I would do on Sunday. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. That's not a work of necessity or mercy. You know, to go visit with folks for a little bit, say hello, chill out, talk for a little bit. But if they want to plop in front of a TV for the rest of the day, I'd be like, okay, well, we're heading on home now. And, because if you're just going to sit and watch a game, you know, you're not going to really be interacting with people anymore. So that's how I would answer that. Also, this individual asked, they play a viola in a paid orchestra that has concerts on Saturdays and Sundays. I'm assuming that would not be permitted either. Yeah, musical concerts, a work of necessity or mercy. It'd be pretty hard to, I think, categorize it, pardon me, as either one of those. But when it comes to the Sabbath day, you know, stick to the wording of the commandment. You know, I believe our confession in toto. I subscribe to that creed and believe everything it says. And I know that the Westminster Divines were concerned about people wasting the whole day playing, you know, like, I forget what game it was they would play where they would roll a ball or something. There was something going on at the time. I can't recall. It's been a while since I've read about it. But they were saying, look, you can't spend the day doing that. That's worldly recreation. Now, I'll go out in the backyard and run around with the kids. You know, they play this game, kids attack the dad and dad attack the kids. We'll do that 10, 15 minutes. I mean, you can't, the kids will pop and explode if you don't get them outside to run around or something. I'm not going to make them sit still the entire day. That wouldn't be good for them. We'll go hiking sometimes, go for walks. I know there are Reformed guys that you shouldn't, you know, walk a certain, too far or something. And I'm thinking, you know, that's awfully close to some of the Pharisaic stuff in the Talmud about, you know, you can't walk more than this number of paces. That's pure nonsense. I'm sorry. That's legalism. That's not taught in Scripture. Holy resting all the day is going to mean different things to different people. But what you want to make sure is, in your heart, you're not looking for ways to make the day just like every other day. The whole day is to be holy, meaning that whole day is set apart. It's supposed to be different from the other days of the week. So, but it's not God's will that we live, you know, that we move about on the Sabbath day paralyzed by fear that we might be violating the Sabbath day. I did that for years. When I first became Reformed, read about the different, there's the continental, you know, position on the Sabbath is much more lax. The Puritan view is much more rigid. You know, I remember reading Cotton Mather, like the greatest sin he ever committed in his childhood was whittling sticks on the Sabbath, like with a pocket knife behind his door, like whittling a stick on it. It's like the greatest sin he ever committed, and how could God ever forgive him? All right. Wow. Interesting. So you want to stick to what the commandment actually does say, and remember the Sabbath is a gift to us, and it's we have those duties of the Sabbath day. It's not a day for our normal job or normal employment, unless we have a job that's a type of mercy or necessity and that sort of thing. So participate in organized sports, organized musical stuff that is going to do stuff on Sunday. Yeah, I would question that and wonder, is that profaning the Sabbath day with something that really should be done on a different day? Now, the church that I came from in Ohio, you would do a Christmas cantata and an Easter cantata on Sunday morning, and that would take the place of the worship service. And that bothered me, man. That really bothered me. That bothered me all the years we were there, and I thought it is not right that they're doing that. It's just not right. And even when I was an elder, I thought I would voice my objection. We should do this on a Saturday. Okay, you want to have a choir special to celebrate the birth of Jesus and the gospel? Well, let's do it on a Saturday, not Sunday morning. And the answer just blew my mind. The answer was, well, if you do it on Saturday night, nobody's going to come to church. Really? That's the excuse. I thought, if that's the case, I mean, that's terrible. Well, we went to a choir piece on Saturday night, so we're too tired to come to church in the morning. That's horrendous. That's terrible. Terrible. Okay, so you don't want to do that. I mean, Sunday, The organized thing you do on Sunday is worship. It's corporate worship. That's the thing that you do. And I encourage people, if you have a church that has an evening service, and there ain't many of them left, you should go to the evening service. You know, when I was a regular church member and then, you know, became a ruling elder, we would, you know, bring our babies to church. We've had health issues that have made that difficult over the past few years with my family. But we, as much as humanly possible, we'd be there for all the services. And made sure that we not only were there because we felt it was right to do that. If your elders call a worship service, you should be there. We always thought that was the case even before I was an elder or a pastor. But also to set a good example for your children, and also set a good example for other people in church, for people that are younger than you in the church. You want to show them this is the way you live your Christian life. This is the kind of commitment that you need to have to your local church. You need to be there for it. So, okay. Have you asked Al Baker why the pastor at the church plant in Clarksville, Tennessee was not qualified for ministry? Nope, I have not. And plus, if I had, I wouldn't discuss it in a forum like this. Not at all. You might ask him. Maybe you should ask him. I'm not sure I fully understand what all went down with that. Okay, thanks for the Mason series. It was, it's like it was written last week. Yeah, seriously. Even though that book is about 100 years old now, 100 years ago, and you have to keep, hitting yourself on the head thinking, you know, he was writing this in the 100 years ago, but it sure sounds like he wrote it last week. You know, it was pretty remarkable. Okay, three services. You have Paul Garvey. You have three services on Sunday. Wow, what time are those services? Are they all three? So does the pastor preach three different sermons, or does he preach the same sermon three times? I mean, I write usually two sermons every Sunday. That's a lot of work. You know, I'm almost done with my AM sermon, and I've done a little bit of studying to start writing my PM sermon. Friday is like my evening sermon writing day. But yeah, okay. Oh, come now. Al Baker acted unjustly. Come on, man. This isn't whoever Monergism, Soli Deo Gloria. This isn't a place for that. Yeah, why don't you send me an email? We can. I mean, I don't really know much about it, honestly. But you should probably take it up with him. I don't really know anything about it. I'll hold him accountable for what? Send me an email, dude. Okay, here. Let me put my email address in here. Send me an email, and we can talk about it. No idea. I think I know who the dude was, and what one issue at least was. I've talked to Dewey Roberts about it. I don't really know. So. Okay, let's see. I thought there was one other thing this person had asked about in another email. He said, I'm looking for covenant theology stuff and the Sabbath. Yeah, these are good topics. I'm gonna try to get to more of this stuff later. Pardon me. Good stuff. This is good stuff. Good questions. And okay. The only other thing I was gonna try to address today, just briefly, was the importance of. Okay, you have more than one pastor. I was gonna say, you have one pastor that's doing three separate sermons, on Sunday. Then that's pretty impressive. He's actually got time to do that in a given week. LOL, you joined Vanguard. I sure did. That doesn't mean I'm privy to everything. Okay, why don't you send me an email? All right, and we'll discuss it. All right, whatever it is you're talking about. Ah, here's my false mug for when I talk about things that are false. I wanted to talk about the importance of the local church, the importance of being a part of the local church and loving your local church. And when I was an undergrad, I was thinking about this earlier today, and went to Ohio University and got there in 1993 is when I graduated from high school. And I was, might not have even been a Christian yet. I knew that I needed to make a lot of changes in my life. And I remember when my parents dropped me off there at the dorm, at freshman dorm, 415 freshman guys in one dorm there at Ohio University. That place was a zoo. And I thought, man, I need to get my act together. I really need to focus on God. I really need to start reading my Bible. I need to do something because I was not doing well in life in general. My parents had done so much for me in trying to help me and lead me to Christ and help me along the way there, but I was pig-headed and dumb and made a lot of dumb decisions and was really wanting to turn things around and really turn back to God. And, you know, immediately was introduced through my sister. My sister was a senior there at Ohio University. And I immediately got involved with Campus Crusade for Christ. And my sister, you know, encouraged me to do that. And I met some really great people there at Campus Crusade for Christ, one of whom ended up being really one of the most important people I have ever met. His name was Rich, and I believe he is a seminary professor somewhere now. But he was just such a wonderful guy, and I just loved him so much. He was so kind to me, and he reached out to me, and he, you know, God really used that guy to encourage me in my walk, and encouraged me to focus on Christ and to read my Bible and to fight against sin. And I just loved him so much. He kept encouraging me to come to a men's event that my freshman year, and he had a special talk that he was going to do, and it was just life altering. It was so good. There were about 80 guys that went to this, and listening to him talk, you know, it was just such an encouraging thing. And it really was a game changing event. I was listening to Rich talk about being a Christian and the struggles that he had as a Christian young man, and they were similar to my own struggles, and it was a real game-changing event, and I was very thankful to God for Campus Crusade for Christ, and also especially for that guy, for my friend Rich, and I've wanted to try to find him and reconnect with him. I mean, that was, my goodness, that was like 26 years ago, but he was just such a great guy. He's a great man of God. So there was that, and there were other groups on campus that I visited and went to a couple times. The Navigators had a Bible study that a number of people went to that I knew. And I met a lot of people. I met a lot of Christian people there in Athens. And on that campus, you know, Ohio University at the time had about, I don't know, maybe 23,000 students. So it was a big school. It was a really big school. And most of the people in the town there were college students. But it was also a very immoral and very liberal school. And there was a lot of partying and a lot of drinking and a lot of promiscuity and a lot of stuff like that going on. And so the Christians there were real Christians. Like, you couldn't be kind of a fence sitter at Ohio University. It was, you were either in or out. You were either a follower of Christ or you were not. So, the people that I met there were some of the finest Christian people to this day, some of the best Christian people I've ever met. And, two guys I met in Campus Crusade for Christ at the Bible study that met in that freshman dorm ended up being roommates with them my sophomore, junior, and senior year, and two of them were, both of them were in my wedding, were in my wedding party, and so it was a great thing. But one thing that for me was a little bit different than the experience of some of the other Christian kids that I met there in college when I was an undergrad, I always felt a little bit uneasy about these parachurch groups. Campus Crusade for Christ, I always kind of thought, you know, these, they went to, there were basically two relatively conservative churches in town there, and the rest of them just kind of weren't. And so if you were a believer, you went to one of these two churches. And so you would see the staff and the people that were the most involved, pardon me, with Crusade and the Navigators and those different, there were a couple other Christian groups there. They would be there at church on Sunday, but it was just kind of like, that's where they went on Sunday. The real action was their parachurch stuff that they did. And even when I was 18 and 19 years old, I just kept thinking, there's something wrong with that. There's something wrong with that because Jesus did not found parachurch stuff. He founded the church. Now, I wasn't overly, I mean, I was reading the Bible all the time back then. I read scripture a lot, but as far as reading good theology, it just wasn't really a part of my life yet. That wouldn't come till later. But I read the Bible enough to kind of see that, you know, there's no connection, or very little connection between some of these campus groups, these campus Christian groups, and a local church. It seems like it just kind of, they do their own thing, and the real action is our parachurch group, and we punch the clock on Sundays and go to these buildings and sing and do worship and stuff like that. But the real action is our parachurch ministry and this movement that we're part of. And I always kind of thought that's a little strange. So at the end of my freshman year, I met the pastor at the other conservative church in town, and became friends with him. And he invited me to come to a men's Bible study. And I basically, for the rest of the time I was in college, my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I really wasn't involved with any parachurch groups at all, really. I still knew people from them. But that church became where I lived my Christian life. I was involved with the stuff that went on at the church. And eventually, that's actually how I met my wife. The pastor there eventually asked me. I played the piano in that church for a couple of years. I mean, I was part of the worship group that, you know, there was a piano and there were a couple of guitars and stuff like that. I played the piano every Sunday for worship, and eventually was asked to teach the college age Sunday school class. There were, you know, well over probably 80 to 100 college kids that attended that church, and you know, that's how I met my wife. That's how I met Amy. Because the pastor, he wanted to have a guy and a girl to kind of lead that college fellowship group so that there'd be a guy to kind of, you know, talk to the guys, and there'd be a girl that could kind of be a mentor to the college age girls. And it was a great thing, because that's how I met, you know, Amy, my wife, was the other person who helped lead that college group. And within 6 weeks, you know, I kind of forgot about every other girl I'd ever met in my life, and was kind of like, man, I've got to get this one for sure. And I remember talking to one of my friends, and he told me, you better get her before somebody else does. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna try. And it took some work, but she was well worth it. But anyway, being part of that church, That really set the tone for the rest of my life in terms of being involved or being a Christian. And being part of a church has always been real important to me. And it's always surprised me how that doesn't seem to be all that important to people quite often who profess to be Christians. And I'm kind of wondering at times, like, you know, the church has kind of fallen on hard times. The church that we went to there in Ohio, you know, that church had about 340 members. I mean, there'd be 300 people there every Sunday. And there was a Wednesday prayer meeting that met, you know, every Wednesday. And I'm telling you, there'd be four or five people show up. 10 people on a good Wednesday night out of a church with 340. And there were activities, do church picnics and like try to do stuff to give people opportunities for fellowship, you know, do a church picnic and 23 people would show up. A church with over 300 people in it, you know, we went to everything. We went to, and I was always just kind of like, why doesn't anybody come to this stuff? You know, don't people want to like be around each other? And you know, what's the deal? And, you know, to me, the church that's where the action is. That's what Jesus founded, was the church. This thing with all these warts on it and all these people with their sin and all these other issues and stuff. So that's where I've always put my lot in. And that's what I want to encourage people. If you're not a part of the life of a local church, you need to be. If you're a professing Christian, that is where the action is in your church. And your pastor and your elders, they need your encouragement. And they need you to get behind them and to encourage them and to write them notes and to let them know that you pray for them and attend stuff. You know, that's one thing. There's three guys here at the church that are doing seminary work that feel a sense of calling to the ministry. And I really want to do everything I possibly can to prepare them for ministry. But there's a lot about ministry work that's really hard. I mean, you'll work your fingers to the bone and study so hard and write and preach and work to perfect sermons and messages and lessons for stuff, and people won't come to it. You'll be like pray and work on stuff, and nobody shows up. Nobody wants to hear what you have to say. And it's like, man, you're down there in the text of scripture working, and you're all fired up and excited about what it says, and you know, you'll do stuff, and very few people will show up. Sometimes it can be extremely discouraging. And yet, you know, you think, well, everybody does see themselves as a professing Christian. And yet there's, you know, at times very little commitment to the local church. Now, I haven't found that to be the case as much here in Tennessee. Not at all. I've been very impressed with the commitment level of the members of the church here. And the church I came from, though, I was always a bit surprised at the lack of attendance. And people falling asleep. And so that was one thing that blew me away, was people sleeping when you would try to preach. I mean, I'd be standing up there preaching my guts out, and it'd be people like, you know, nodding off. There's a guy in that church that I have no memories of this guy being awake. He figured out a way to sit there and prop his head up on his chin, and he would sleep the entire service unless everyone had to stand to sing or something like that. It was unbelievable. You know how when you sit in a church, you tend to sit in the same places? So this is before I was a pastor. I always sat with this guy like right up here next to me. And it was just, I mean, you couldn't help but notice it because his head would nod a little bit. It was weird. He would sleep the entire service. And I thought, what's the point of coming to church and just sleeping the whole service? Just so weird. So weird. But anyway, the church in our country today, it's fallen on hard times. You know, it really is. And there's such a need for expositional preaching that's doctrinal to the core, and the teaching of the Christian faith, especially to the young, and teaching them apologetics, teaching them how to be confident, engaging people in evangelism and not, you know, getting scared or nervous and just being calm. And also what it is to live the Christian life. I mean, you want to participate in the life of your church, but the primary place for the Christian, though, is out there in the world, is out there being married, or if you're married, is working your job and having integrity in your job and doing an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. Christians should be the very best at everything like that. We should be the most reliable employees, and we don't witness to people on company time. You know, if you're going to talk to people about the gospel, you do it during lunch or after work, or if you're on a legitimate break. You know, some people take breaks every 10 minutes. That's not appropriate either. But I just want to encourage everybody to be sure that you love your local church. It is not for the faint of heart to be an elder. It is not for the faint of heart to be a pastor either. Because no matter what, somebody doesn't like what you have to say or how you have to say it. No matter what, people are going to get upset at you. You know, I made the comment when the coronavirus thing happened. We did live streaming, I believe, shorter than any church that I know of in this entire, within a 100-mile radius of where I'm sitting right here. I think we live streamed for 4, maybe 5 Sundays. And then we reopened the church and got right back to it. And I preached a sermon on how, whether you agreed with that or not, that should not be a reason you leave a local church. We should love with a love that covers over what we perceive to be a multitude of sins in others. This is not worth leaving a church over. And I knew that no matter what I said or how I said it, that we'd probably lose some people. And we did. There are people who think that we, you know, people from churches all over the place, and you hear fussing and all sorts of things. People shouldn't have opened as quickly as they did, and they're putting people at risk. And some you shouldn't have closed at all, because you're saying the magistrates don't have the authority to do that. Of course, our magistrates never ordered us to do anything. So even if we had wanted to get in trouble with the magistrate, if I had stood on the steeple with a megaphone, "We're having church, we don't care what the magistrate says," they'd be like, "We didn't tell you to do anything. We didn't give you any orders. Okay, we made a recommendation. Okay, there's a pandemic. This disease looks pretty nasty. You might want to stay home so it doesn't spread. If it's in this area, we certainly don't want to spread it if it's as contagious as people are saying that it is." I think that we were misled pretty badly by a lot of that stuff, honestly. And we all think that. But at the time, we still think that we made the right decision given what was available to us. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I've never heard of anything like it. Where you see on the internet, I mean, every country on this planet, except, you know, the continent of Antarctica, but every other country in the world is keeping track of cases and deaths and all kinds of stuff like that. And we thought, wow, you know, maybe we thought the best decision was we should, okay, live stream for as short a time as possible. That was always the goal, as short as possible. We want to, you know, keep people safe, but I did that thinking, this is going to be a good test, actually. This will be a good test. How committed are people to their membership vows? How committed are they to the local church? There are a handful of things that I think are worth leaving a church over. One would be a gross moral collapse where there's cover-up and there's gross immorality or there's lying and things like that are being covered up or whatever by the leadership. It's time to leave a church if people do things like that. If there's fatal defection from the gospel, if there's fatal defection from the doctrine of the true God, or a fatal defection from a biblical doctrine of sin or something like that, then it would be time to leave, because those are essential. Okay, those are essential truths. But a church, whether you agree with it or not, if it did live streaming for a few Sundays, that's not something you should leave a church over. That is not something that you should leave a church over. Plus, I wondered if you did leave your church over that issue, where in the world are you going to go? Every other church in the whole area did it too, and did it longer than we did. So anyway, you need to love your local church. You need to be committed to your local church. You need to have a sense of, these are my people, and these are my friends, these are my brothers and sisters. We're going to rejoice with those who rejoice, or weep with those who weep. But the local church is where the action is. That's where you have the means of grace. You know, I remember even before my ecclesiology developed, just reading my Bible a lot, I used to wonder, you know, Campus Crusade for Christ, as much as there are precious, wonderful Christian people involved with that, I thought, you know, they don't baptize people because they can't. They're not a church. They don't have communion or the Lord's Supper. But for some of the people there, really seemed like the prime time meeting on Thursdays, that was their church. That was more important to them than their local church. And the leadership functioned like elders in their lives. And that's not right. That's not appropriate. That's not a church. So, just want to encourage y'all. I didn't really have... Actually, real quick here, let me see. I might have put another email in here. Okay. Oh, there was another, another question about a very difficult passage in Leviticus. I will get to that one later, but I would need to look into it a little bit more. So anyway, let's see if anyone's chatting over here. Okay, I don't see any other questions. Okay, does anybody have a question that's in there chatting? That doesn't involve, you know, personal ugly stuff going on in the denomination that I'm not even really privy to. If you do, please do ask. Going once and going twice. All right, I'm going to go ahead and we're at the 40-minute mark, and I've still got some serious sermon writing to do. I'm in full-on sermon writing mode, so I'd really like to get my AM sermon finished before I go home today. Rudy Manrique. Is that how you say your last name? Manrique? What do you think of republication? Republication. Okay, well, actually, let's look up that word. Republication. Let's look it up in the Noah Webster 1828 dictionary. Hello? No. Where is it? Noah Webster's 1828 dictionary is available online. 1828 dictionary. And you can type it in here. Let's see what the word means. Republication. Means a second publication or a new publication of something before published. Well, what do I think of republication? The Covenant of Works was not republished at Mount Sinai because it can't be republished. There can no more be a republication of the Covenant of Works than there could be another incarnation of the Son of God. There could no more be a republication of the Covenant of Works than there could be another exodus of Israel out of Egypt. There can be no more be a republication of the Covenant of Works than there could be another resurrection of Jesus, or crucifixion of Jesus, for that matter, or another Pentecost. Okay, the Covenant of Works is with Adam and all of his posterity in him. Now, if you're going to say it's republished at Sinai, okay, who's the new covenant mediator then? Who's the new representative of the entire human race then? Oh, we're not saying that. That's not what we mean by republication. Okay, well, what do you mean then? What do you mean then? Here's why I don't believe in republication. I don't believe in republication because the giving of the law at Mount Sinai did not change the gospel at all. You know how I know that? Because Paul said that Abraham was justified by faith alone. In Romans chapter 4, quoting from Genesis 15:6. And then he quotes from Psalm 32. David was justified by faith alone. When does David come in relationship to the giving of the law at Mount Sinai? He comes after it, right? But long time after it. He's justified by faith alone as well. But the primary reason that I don't believe in republication is because the Apostle Paul didn't. Now, of course, they're going to cry foul at this, but anyway. Is the law then against the promises of God? Okay. Galatians 3:21. Is the law then against the promises of God? If it's republished at Sinai, I guess you'd have to say, yeah, it's against the promises of God. But if you watch, there's that video out there where I think it's the senior, Renahan Senior, James Renahan, says eventually, I remember watching that video about 1689 federalism, and the whole time I'm watching it, they're like, hey, the Covenant of Works is republished. It's republication. And I'm like, okay, they've eventually got to say this. I'm like, come on, you eventually got to say it. You got to say it. And then Renahan's like, now we're not saying that it's republished in the sense that now you have to keep it to be justified before God. I'm like, right, you do agree with us. There's one covenant of grace. It's administered in different ways, but it's still the same covenant of grace. And it's not the new covenant. Okay, the new covenant is not in force. It's not in force until the death of that covenant testator. Okay? It's not in force until the death of the covenant testator. Okay? Now, Hebrews 9, verse 17 teaches this. Okay? It says, Diathe ke gar, okay, for a covenant, epi nekrois bebaya, okay, is in force after men are dead. Okay, Babaya. What does Babaya mean? Firm, secure, in force. Okay, the testament, the last will and testament, the diatheke, is in force after men are dead. Okay? So the death of Jesus puts the new covenant, Babaya, in force. Okay, so you can't say Abraham and Isaac were in it because it's not in force until Jesus is dead on the cross. Until his death, the covenant is not Babaya. It is not in force. Okay, so Rudy, thank you for that question. It's always a delight to talk about republication again. And if you really want to understand it, you need to spend the rest of your life reading everything Brandon Adams has ever uploaded to his meandering website about the topic. And it just goes pages and it's billions of pages long. Okay, that's a useless topic. So thanks for bringing that up again, man. You just did that to push my buttons, didn't you? I haven't heard from you in a little while. But anyway, everybody, thanks for watching. Hope this program was of use to somebody for something. But anyway, thank you all. Love y'all. Appreciate y'all. Monergism, Soli Deo Gloria, email me what you're talking about. I'm glad to, you know, that we can interact. I actually don't even know who you are. But we can talk about that if you'd like. Thank you for watching or for listening. Pastor Patrick Hines of Bridle Heights Presbyterian Church, and you've been listening to the Pulpit Supplemental Podcast. You can find us on the web at www.bridwellheightspca.org. Our sermons are streamed through Sermon Audio, and you can listen to that on the iTunes podcast version of Bridle Heights Presbyterian Church. Feel free to join us any Sunday morning for worship at 11 a.m. sharp at 108 Bridwell Heights Road in Kingsport, Tennessee. And may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.